Thank you.
Hi, my name's Stacy F., and my sobriety date is 8-4 of 08, and my home group is the Coffee Pot here in Eureka Springs. And welcome, everyone. It's wonderful to be here, and I had the privilege to pick up Gail at the airport. I had no idea who I was picking up, what she was like, but I picked her up, and it was the fastest trip I've ever made from that airport. We talked and talked and talked, and as I was driving crazy, you know, just used to all these curves, she goes, "I don't remember the curves being this bad around here." And I said, "Oh, I'm sorry. Am I driving too fast? You know, because I'm just so used to him." She goes, "No, I'm just glad you're sober." So, and I said, "I am too." But she knows so much about the history. I've enjoyed spending some time with her, and I know you're going to enjoy this. Come on up, Gail.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name's Gail, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm honored to be here and be on the program again this year, although it should say almost springtime in the Ozarks. The sun is coming out, and I'm getting a little vitamin D, so that's good. This is kind of an appropriate talk for today. Let's see if I can take this out. Is this going to upset anybody if I... I think I got a little room here to wiggle. It says all-inclusive and never exclusive. And that's not always the way it was. And the story I'm going to tell today will illustrate that. But to start off with, this is by request. Somebody wants to put this up in their woodworking shop. I don't have much time to actually qualify. I don't tell my story. I tell our story. My sobriety date is... hecklers up front here. May 13th, 1978 is my sobriety date. And this is kind of a bohemian town, and for all the hippies out here, I'd like to tell you that that was Woodstock. It's not. It's Slade, Kentucky, and that's a half gallon of wine there, and there's a deck of cards in one hand, a cigarette in the other, can of beer off to my right. And yes, my zipper is down. I hope that's enough of an introduction. And you, can anyone here identify? Okay, because I'm going to start with the story. I called it The Women Behind the Men, but you know we have Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, and I thought about calling it Dr. Bob and the Good Old Gals. Now, Dr. Bob called women frails, so I thought, well, maybe I should call it Tales of the Frails. And of course, when we think about our history, and maybe it's time we took a look at our herstory. So here he comes now, but first, the nurses. And there's Dr. Bob. And they loved it. Boy, this is going to be a fun crowd. Yeah, and when I started walking over here to, like, plug into everything, everybody was leaving town. I'm, like, going, come back, come back. Anyway, the story actually starts in Akron. The way the Oxford Group comes to Akron is because this guy on the left, who I dearly love, is Jim Newton. And God can use womanizers in this program because he's chasing pretty girls in Massachusetts. And he thinks he's a young luggage salesman, and he thinks he's on his way to the singles dance. He follows him into a hotel, and it ends up being an Oxford Group meeting. And this guy becomes an Oxford Group member, and he helps sober up the guy on the right, who's Russell Firestone, the son of the great industrialist. You know, and they had given up hope on this guy, so this is a big miracle that this guy gets sober through a trip on a train to Denver, where he's going to make a surrender in a train car coming home. Actually, Sam Shoemaker was in that car, for any of you that know a little bit about the history. So there's Jim. He later goes down to Fort Myers. He works with Thomas Edison down there. And his wife, the woman behind him, was Eleanor Ford. And she wrote a book that both of these people were active in the Oxford Group, later MRA, Moral Rearmament. And she wrote a book called Guidance to God that we read. You know, we didn't always have conference-approved literature. So we chewed on this little book that she wrote. And Harvey Firestone here was so grateful for his son's recovery that those of you that know the story of the prodigal son in the Bible, where the son gets saved and he comes home and the father is so excited, what does he do? He throws a dinner for the son. Well, that's what Harvey Firestone did. He invited the Oxford Group to Akron. Now, the Oxford Group was for the down and uppers. If you were down and out, you went to the Salvation Army. So all of our society comes out to meet them, and they traveled like an army for God. So it was quite a big deal when they came to town. And there's Frank Buchman, who was the founder of the Oxford Group, who came with them. And but behind Russell, Bud Firestone, who will actually give testimony at the dinner that the father holds, is his wife. And this is Dorothy. And Dorothy Firestone was really the inspiration. She was the one that really caught fire and was inspirational in bringing the group to Akron. And actually, when they did come, they had women's meetings and men's meetings with the Oxford Group, and she conducted the women's meeting there. Now, behind Frank Buchman, this is a little church from Keswick, England, where Frank Buchman is going to get sober. Not sober, I'm sorry. Well, kind of, mentally anyway, because he had a lot of resentments. Now, I know a lot of you in this room find that hard to believe. But he did. And he was in this church. It was a revival going on. And in that church, there was a woman preacher. And she was talking about the cross. And Buchman, and that's Jesse Penn Lewis there, and he has a conversion experience. And right after that conversion experience, actually that night, he begins to write amends letters, and that's where we get amends from. He is the founder of the Oxford Group movement, which was a return to first century Christianity, which is what we were for the first years in Akron and in New York before we had our book. Now, there's a picture of the Mayflower Hotel. It's newly opened at this time. Yeah, we're in a depression, and our co-founders thought that that was providential because people come together in hard times. And, you know, the stock market crashes in 1929, but Akron has set aside money for the opening of this grand hotel. And in January of 31 is when the big party, it was called a house party. And not only will there be a big dinner, but there will be, they will keep them in town, and they will have house parties in the morning and at night, and they will go out into the pulpits of the churches. And it's like the seeds of our birth are being sown. The ground is being prepared. And at that time, Henrietta on the left, that's Henrietta Seiberling, and Ann Smith are going to get involved in the Oxford Group. Now, Dr. Bob used to have a lot of friends, but he doesn't have too many at this time because it's a depression. He's depressed. His alcoholism is getting the best of him, and he's kind of down and out. So these two women had a lot of power. They put some mojo on Bob, I think, you know. Manipulation for sure. And they talked him into coming into the Oxford Group. And when he came in, it would be much like coming into an AA meeting today. There would have been a lot of laughter, a lot of fellowship, and he liked them. Liked him a lot. The only problem, and he did everything they asked him to do. He read all the books. He read the Bible. He went back to church, something he swore he'd never do again. He went to their meetings. He prayed. Everything they asked him to do. But in 2.5 years, Dr. Bob did not get sober with the very same principles that we have today. Something to think about. So let's take a look at who's behind Dr. Bob. There's his beautiful wife, Ann Smith. And here she is, and she's looking out the window, and I like this picture because I think it best illustrates their courtship. They courted for 17 years. So there's a lady in waiting if I ever saw one. I don't know, maybe she's waiting for him to sober up. I don't know, but Dr. Bob was a little slow, maybe. I don't know. But here's a picture of her as a little girl. And you can see she was just a sweet, sweet, charming person, probably even before she got involved in the Oxford Group. I mean, she was a school teacher, too. Now, as I said, they are going to attend the Oxford Group for 2.5 years, but Bob can't identify. You know, the Oxford Group wanted to be all things to all people. And you know, Bob is not about to share his alcoholism there, and Ann's not sharing either. So the woman on the left, again, is Henrietta, but the woman on the right is Delphine Weber. Now, when you take a look at the pieces of each slide, if you go to remove one person from this story, we maybe don't gather in the Ozarks this weekend. This thing comes together through a series of coincidences. And one of them is that Delphine Weber on the right is going to call Henrietta Seiberling. She's going to say, what are we going to do about Dr. Bob and Ann Smith? They're not sharing. She says, what do you mean, what are we going to do? She said, well, he's a terrible alcoholic. They're ready to foreclose on his home. They're ready to take his business. Everything's, you know, his family's a mess. Everything's a mess. So Henrietta Seiberling goes into meditation. Well, actually, she goes into guidance, and that's what they did. In the Oxford Group days, you got up in the morning, you read from scripture or for some spiritual book, and then you waited and you listened, and you listened to see what God would say to you. And much of what happened in Akron came from people who were listening for guidance. And then what you would do is you would call someone up, and you would check your guidance, and you would run it by the four absolutes. Honesty, purity, unselfishness, and love to make sure that that voice wasn't coming from your ego. It's kind of like what we use a sponsor today for. So she decides that she's going to call a special meeting for Dr. Bob. Now, today, if you turn on your TVs, you can see a program called Intervention. That word was not around back in 1935 dealing with people. It was through her guidance that she was told to call a meeting, special meeting. She told the people to come, and she said, we're going to share, and we're going to share deeply, and there's not going to be any pussy footing around. It tells you a little bit about Henrietta Seiberling. She was serious. The meeting was on Monday, but on Wednesday at 8 o'clock, they would hold that meeting in this home. And the people up there on the left, that's T. Henry and Clarice Williams. And I mention her because back in the 30s, the men went off to work, but the homes were the woman's place. And a lot of our recovery is going to take place in homes. So I think we owe the women, and the movie hasn't been done on what happened in Akron yet. You know, you've seen My Name is Bill W., and you've seen When Love is Not Enough. You haven't learned much about what happened in Akron, and it was the homes in Akron that opened up, and it was the women that opened those doors up to the hospitality, because people would start flying in from all over to get the cure. And so these good folks, actually, much of what we're going through now is a lot of foreclosures. They were going through foreclosures at this time. The thaw on the left, T. Henry, he was a tire mold inventor for National Rubber Machinery Shop, and coincidentally, that was the shop that Bill was coming in the proxy takeover fight. He was going to take over that company. This poor guy's going to lose his house because of Bill Wilson, because they're going to foreclose on homes. He's lost his job, and that close to losing the home, they had let go, and they said, this is God's home. So when Henrietta calls them up, they let her use their home for this intervention, which is going to take place on Wednesday at 8 o'clock. And it'll take place in the living room. And I don't know what they all said. I mean, what would those down and uppers have to say? Can you just imagine them all sitting around? They're not alcoholics, and they're going to share what? They touched the kitchen stove, burnt their hand, and said a bad word. I don't know what they shared. We have no recording of that. But we do know when it came Dr. Bob's turn, there was a long pause. And he thanked them, and he looked up at them. And he said, now I've got something I need to share with you. I am a secret drinker, and I cannot stop. Step one. And they said something that I think is very important. They said, Bob, would you like us to pray for you? And he said, yes. And they get down on their knees in that living room here, and they say a prayer for Dr. Bob. And 2 weeks later, Bill Wilson's going to come to town. Meanwhile, Henrietta, in her quiet time, loved Dr. Bob, and she began to pray for Bob. And this is what she says to God. But I told Bob, that I was sure if he lived this way of life, he could quit drinking. Now I need your help, God. This is what God says to her. Bob must not touch one drop of alcohol. Well, she got so excited about that guidance that she She calls Ann up. She goes, Ann, I got guidance for Bob. Bob jumps in one of his cars and goes racing down to the little house down the street. And she tells him that, and he was pretty disappointed. He kind of thought it'd be about some mountain moving or something. And so she's living here in this little gate lodge where she continues to pray. And now there's two stages where our story takes place. And this is part of the Akron stage, but we'll talk a little bit here about Bill. And the gal behind Bill was this Lois. And Lois is a doctor's daughter, and I don't think she knew what she was getting herself into. And you know, we've got a lot of bikers here. I can hear you guys riding up and down the street, and a lot of you come to Akron, and a lot of us think, oh, Bill and Lois had that Harley, a 1929 Harley with a sidecar, right? We're pretty proud of that. Well, it was Lois that drove that sidecar. Bill would be in the sidecar, and he would be working on his stock work and stuff, and so on. So this is up. Yeah, all right. Bikers, you can claim her. And I don't know how many of you saw the movie When Love Is Not Enough, but it certainly brought out the drama of what life was like for Lois living with Bill. I mean, that movie really, I think, brought that out. And here are the pledges. And do you remember in the movie where it talks about Bill's pledges in the Bible? I'm going to see if I can read these to you so that we have these hanging in the archives in Akron, and they're so powerful for those of you that have made similar pledges that you weren't going to drink anymore. Bill puts in the Bible, to my beloved wife that has endured so much, let this stand as evidence of my pledge to you that I have finished with drink forever. October 20th, 1928, Bill. Shortly after that, Thanksgiving Day, 1928, my strength is renewed 1,000-fold in my love for you. Once again, January 12th of 1929, he says, to tell you once more that I am finished with it, I love you. And September 3rd, 1930, he says, finally and for a lifetime, thank God for your love. And thank God for the love of Lois Wilson. How those women kept those men alive so that that day, that Mother's Day weekend, could come in Akron where the miracle could happen. It's just a testimony. Have you ever seen the play Bob and Bill? For those of you that've seen that, when you take the story and put it into drama, I remember I saw it for the first time in Boston, and right about intermission, I'm screaming for those women to leave those guys. I was so mad at them. And then I thought, well, you know, if they had left them, where would we be? So after Bill has his spiritual awakening in Towns Hospital and he sees how his experience can benefit others, do you know what he does? He starts to look for drunks. He goes into Oxford groups. He about knocks a person down looking for another drunk. And he begins being a missionary and hauling them into his house. And he fills Clinton Street with drunks. And he's not working, so Lois is supporting everybody. They're not charging the drunks anything. And nobody's getting sober, by the way. One of them even, while they're out of town, sells all their clothes and gasses himself in the house. Now remember, this is Lois's home. Actually, this was her father's house. And so Bill's going to get kind of depressed about that. After all, he's put in all this work and all these months to all these guys, and not one has gotten sober. And Lois says something to Bill that has to come before he comes to Akron. She says to him, but Bill, you're sober. That is so important because he is going to find himself on this business deal in the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel. And he's going to be pacing that lobby, and you know the story well because it's in your book, and the book is a great history book. And he's going to hear the tinkling of the glasses, and he's going to go in, and he's going to strike up a conversation when he remembers what Lois says to him. And he walks over to the directory, and the directory picks the most perfect name he can pick out of that directory. He picks Reverend Tunks. And we don't know why. It's one of those coincidences again. But they think it's when Bill went for a walk. You know, those Vermonters had those great little terms for everything. And he said he was taking a tunk. Well, that's why he may have picked Reverend Tunks' name. And there's Reverend Tunks, and he's working on his sermon. And to the left of the door is his office when that phone call comes in, and through a series of phone calls, he's going to get in touch with Henrietta Seiberling. Now, I don't know how many of you know this, but through a series of events, when he gets her number, he's going to walk away from the phone. He doesn't want to call Henrietta Seiberling. Henrietta Seiberling? Well, that's the big rubber company. She's probably the president's wife of Goodyear. I can't call her. And he walks away from the phone, and he hears a voice say to him, "You better call that lady." Thank God Bill was a listener, huh? And so he walks up. He does not make that call from the lobby. He goes up to his room, and he places the call. Now, again, he thought she was living in this. If you've ever been to Akron, you know, for a humble birth, God picks mangers. Well, in Akron, he didn't pick the big house that's on the property where our miracle and our birth is going to occur. This is where he thought the president was wife was living. However, who he calls is not the president's wife. It's the daughter-in-law of Henrietta. Her name's Henrietta Seiberling. She's been groomed in Texas to marry a Vanderbilt. And she ended up with this Seiberling kid. And he didn't work out too well, so she separated from him. And I think he's drinking at the big house. And she's living at the little house with her children. And it's pretty humble. And what day did God pick? Since this is a talk about women, he picked Mother's Day weekend. You know, I heard Madeline last night, and she talked about being a mother. She talked what it meant to her to get sober. And I kind of looked over to my friend Bob, because we're talking about putting on a little celebration in Akron for Mother's Day weekend next year. So stay tuned. And what a gift that God chose that day. Think of how many mothers whose sons and daughters are sober, and how many mothers. You know, I'm a child of two alcoholic parents. And whenever I work with another woman, I remember what it was like to be that child. And I'm glad we have a solution today. And that's Henrietta there. Now, Henrietta is going to put Bill up at the Portage Country Club. This is the old money club in Akron. I've only been there one time for a Sweet 16 party. And Bill ends up broke, and he ends up there. Isn't that like Bill's story? He's just up, and he's down. So he's broke, but the next thing you know, he's out on the golf course at the Portage Country Club playing a little golf. I photoshopped him in out there because I'm sure that's what he did. And then I have a few pictures here to show you of Henrietta that you won't often see in our conference-approved literature, because some of this comes from their archives. She has her baby in the tower of that house. He becomes a congressman, John Seiberling. She's a beautiful woman. And I'm going to let her, and she was really the first terrorist, because when she found her husband was fooling around, I've read some of the documents there, and the kids especially were scared to death that she's going to take those grandkids and spill all the beans, see, because she was a pretty serious lady. I'm going to let you hear how serious she was when she tells you a little bit about how she viewed us.
"We are not out to please the alcoholics. They've been pleasing themselves all these years. We are out to please God, and if you don't talk about what God does and your faith and your guidance, you might as well be the Rotary Club or something, because that's your only source of power." And
just a little taste. We don't have any Rotary Club members here, do we? Here's some other pictures. She would eventually leave Akron, and then she would come back and stay in the Gate Lodge over the summer. She never did really get a divorce, but she ends up going to New York, and she chased Bill around for quite a while with her Bible. I think they reconciled after a while, but she gave him a hard time. The Smith home is going to open up, you know, and they're going to invite Bill in, and Bill's going to stay with us in Akron for a couple months, and Bob and Bill just become the best of friends. Now, that doesn't mean that they always agreed. Smitty used to say if it was up to Dr. Bob, AA would have never left Akron, and if it was up to Bill, he'd have franchised it. But they were very good friends, and another thing they agreed on, that alcoholics just had a knack for picking out great women. And there's the Smith home, and this Smith home is going to open up first to Bill and then to many an alcoholic. And during the early days, it was just like an open house. And they would meet. And in our early literature, they said the AA church was the kitchen table. And so they would meet, and they would drink a lot of coffee, and Bill would put the coffee on. I got a little coffee pot somebody gave me here. And you have a club here that is known for its coffee pot. Well, the coffee pot was a symbol of hospitality, and the coffee was always on. They went through about 8 pounds a week there, I think. And but it would be Anne who would feed the spiritual pablum, is what she called it. And she would open the Bible, and she would open to the book of James. And she would always close with, "Faith without works is dead, and God is love." And her Bible is on display at the house. Well, as I said, the women opened up their homes, and as Lois was taken care of and going through some of her experiences, I think some guy got naked and ran through the house. I mean, she has a lot of great stories of the early drunks there. Well, Anne has a story, too, and she was feeding this guy, Eddie R., who was really, he didn't make it, but he would have been the third man in. And they drug he and his wife and everybody in, and he was quite a character. He slid down the drain pipe, is going to throw himself into Lake Erie, and Bob and Bill had to go get him. So he was kind of a nutcase, and one day Ann fed him this tuna fish sandwich. Well, that's not the tuna fish sandwich, but I'm trying to help you out a little bit. So Ann makes this tuna fish sandwich for him, and he goes crazy. And he starts chasing her around the house with the butcher knife. And she is scared to death, and she gets down on her knees, and she's saying the Lord's Prayer, and in comes Bill just in the nick of time to take away that knife. So those early women went through a lot, you know. I don't know if I would have put up with that for long. And I want to mention the Smith children because they had a daughter. There's Smitty there. Some of you have met Smitty. They did make it around the country in their later years and shared. And that's his sister Sue. She was adopted. They were both the same age. She was adopted at about the age of 5, and I have to mention her. And they're sitting in between the Bible here. They were visiting at the house, and I got to take their picture. And they didn't always get along, so they actually asked me to take this picture. They posed for this. But she would want me to tell you that she was the first Alateen. And these kids would give up their bedrooms, as many of the early pioneer children did. They gave up their parents, basically, because this was a serious deal. And they were having meetings all the time, and these kids, of course, they were dating and sneaking around all the time, so I don't know how much they really minded, but they did have to give up their bedrooms for some of the detoxing that was going on in the home. Now, the third guy, they had to let Eddie go, and they go, Bob's going to call up City Hospital, and he's going to tell them, "I got a cure for alcoholism." And, you know, Bob's only sober a little bit. He had that relapse, and he has just come back from that relapse. And they say to him, and they know, both Bob and Bill know, they can't stay sober unless they work with another drunk. So they get busy right away. And they call up, and the nurse said, "Well, Bob," and he says, "I got a cure for alcoholism." And the nurse says, "Well, Bob, have you tried it on yourself?" Anyway, they got this guy strapped to the bed, you know, and he's pretty wild when he's drinking. Nice guy when he's sober. This is Bill D. But let's find out who's behind Bill D. This is his lovely wife. Her name is also Henrietta. And she had been praying for him. She even fired her minister. It wasn't helping him at all. And she told the minister, "You aren't reaching him. I'm going to find someone who can, even if I have to see everyone in Akron." So she prayed with the pastor of another church that someone her husband could understand would visit him in City Hospital. Tell me about the power of prayer. That's another prayer I'm telling you about, huh? So, now at this time, the approach, now we know we have the Little Rock approach. Well, we had an approach too, and Bob had come up with this, is that you work with the women first. And so they would tell the wives, before they even approach the man, they would work with the wives. So he says to her, "The little woman wants to see you at the house." And Anne greets her at the door, and she says, she goes, "Hello, Mrs. Smith," and she says, "Anne to you, my dear." And in her writing, she tells us what a difference that made, the humility of Anne Smith and the way she was greeted. She and Anne would talk by phone in the guidance, and Anne called her every morning for well over a year to check that guidance. And we know that the two men will go and visit Bill D, and this is an artist's rendition. They wouldn't have taken him the 12 steps. They would have taken him the four absolutes. Those are the only yardsticks we had in Akron. We didn't have much then. It was just one drunk talking to another drunk. And the two men are there, and on July 4th of 1935, Bill D is going to walk out of City Hospital a free man to never drink again. And it says so in your big book, and it also says that this is when group number one began. So the next time you see fire in the sky, remember it's our Independence Day too, because it took the third guy. And Bill would often refer to him in his writings as the man who kept the faith, because this guy's going to stay sober. His link will not break. And I always thought we should have the gal on the bed. And I actually had the opportunity to get the gal on the bed. I had posed for a couple dumb shots, but they were actually doing a movie, and they were using my bedroom for the man on the bed. And I said, you can, as long as I can go put on the wife beater shirt. But when I posed for this picture, it was one problem. When I saw it, I'm smiling. And all I could think of is, you'd be smiling too if you were getting 13 step by Dr. Bob and Bill. Now, speaking of the first 13th step, you might want to know a little history on that. It took place in Dr. Bob's office. Now, Dr. Bob was a proctologist. I suppose that's why he was so good with us, don't you think? So we had the first woman in Akron. It's 1939. Her name was Lil. And the fourth guy is Ernie G. Well, he doesn't come up there yet. No, she's on the operating table with a former mayor. And they're doing the wild thing. And they send Ernie G up, who's the fourth man, to get that thing settled down. And the mayor was willing to get to stop, but she wasn't. And she ran around the room. She got into the medicine cabinet. She grabbed a bunch of pills, and then she tried to throw herself out the window. And Ernie grabbed her just in the nick of time. Gals, that set us back quite a bit in Akron. They took her back to Dr. Bob's house, they cleaned her up, and it was a great embarrassment at that time for us. But you know what? You guys had your own embarrassment here. I've been down in the archives talking to Perry, and we found some information that I thought you might find interesting in this talk, so I'm going to bring it home now. You had some phony... Oh, by the way, this comes out of how AA got started in Arkansas. This is on page 6, last paragraph. Phonies and floozies came to AA as they do to anything that is open. Does anybody know who wrote that? I'd like to see them later with their sponsor. The phonies were soon gone, but one day in walks Floozy, in tears, broke, hungry, alone, with a black eye, many bruises, and of course, a sad tale. Macy H. had moved from Little Rock, but three more women had joined the group. Two of the three were assigned to work with Floozy, but she preferred the male attention. A week passed, and then the news spread. Floozy and six of the prospects were over in a hotel room, naked and drunk. Then the full truth came out. In addition to the prospects, three old-timers were in on the deal and were acting as errand boys to the liquor store. I didn't make this up. It's the new girl and one of the girls, with some sobriety, had joined the party. Great were the rumblings, head-shaking and finger-pointing. Meeting time finally came, and the decision was made, no women in the group. Now, you know you had the Little Rock plan? Well, now you had the no woman rule. The no woman rule. Actually, if you go down into the archives, you can find some history on the first man who broke the no woman rule. That actually made history. This case here is a case we've dedicated to Ann Smith. We call her the mother of AA, and she certainly deserves that title. We talk a lot about Bob and Bill, but sometimes we forget about these women. They were as much a part of AA as the men. They didn't have, it was all one big group. And you see the coffee pot there, which might mean something to some of you who have that coffee pot group here. That's a symbol of hospitality from the Smith home. The original is now at Brown University, but there's plenty of hospitality at Dr. Bob's. We have some of the early, she kept notes. She had a little workbook that she kept notes in. And as you can see there to the left, there was an early publication, a Methodist publication. Do we have any Methodists in the room? Because you're going to want to know this. Your book, your little upper room, came out in spring of 1935. We read that. That was our first devotional. I don't know how many of you knew that. And of course, she read from the Bible. And now I'm hoping her voice will work. This is a new computer, and we have one recording of Ann Smith's voice taken from the bedroom of her home that was taken from a wire, and I haven't tested it with my new computer, but we'll see if she'll talk to us. She will, but it's too low. Do I have my sound guy here? Can you hear him? He said he promised me he'd stay. You know, I have abandonment issues. There's got to be an Alan to the rescue before long. I think it's going to be too late to hear her voice, but she's there. She just isn't talking real loud right now, but it was the only recording we have of her voice. You know, the women stayed in the background. Bill had actually asked her to write a chapter to the book, but she said she just wanted to stay in the background. So that's kind of how she was. Sorry about that. The Smith home was open, and this is Archie Towbridge. He came in November of 1938. His story in the book is The Fearful One, or The Man Who Mastered Fear. He came in, and he was sick. So the Smiths took them in. And, you know, I mean, sometimes for dinner, there was only bread and butter. But they said to him, as long as we have a house, our house is your house. And he claims that that he had been taken off the streets and nurtured back to health by Ann Smith. Now, here's what was happening in Akron. This guy's from Detroit. He's going to come into Akron. He's going to get nurtured back to health. 10 months later, he's going to go back and start AA in Detroit. So they were flying in from all over to get the cure, and then they would take AA back to their hometowns because all the 12-step working was going on in Akron. Dr. Bob was the prince of 12-steppers. And in that house that I showed you, remember the house where they did the intervention? They're going to continue to meet at that house on Wednesday at 8 o'clock, the same day and the same time that that prayer was said. And so Dr. Bob, the drunks couldn't sit still for the guidance part, and they'd start jonesing and shaking, so Dr. Bob would take them up to the upper room, and that's where he'd get the surrenders. So anyway, this guy is going to go back, and this is Ernie. Ernie is going to hook up with Sue, and that's because Dr. Bob manipulated this. She had another boyfriend, Ray, who you're going to meet in a minute, but he gives this guy this guy's the fourth guy in. He's kind of young, and he's the fourth guy in, and Bob gives him some money to take Sue out to get a hamburger, and they end up getting married. And Bob and Ann weren't too happy about that, but geez. And this is the Galbraith family, who was also part of AA. Mama Galbraith would go and get the upper rooms, and she would pass them out because they were meeting in the homes all the time. And they would go. Now, you know, I told you Oxford Group did that checking thing. Well, alcoholics didn't like that too much. And they would go into your bathroom and check to see if the upper room was open to the right day and see if you were maximum, you know. Yeah, you wouldn't have liked it either. So that's a picture of Sue and Ernie and Mama Galbraith. Now, the love story of Ray and Sue, see, the Smiths didn't think Ray was good enough for Sue. And so that's why they manipulated and got Ernie. Well, after Ernie dies and the Smiths are gone, Ray and Sue get back together again. And I knew them both, and it's just kind of a sweet story there. And there were other people in Akron. There was Wally and Annabelle G, and there was Johnny and LG. And these are other people. I'll have to try and look up their homes, because these are people that also took people into their homes, taught them how to pray, taught them how to meditate, taught them this way of life. And that's how AA actually spread, would go out from Akron. Also in 1939, Dr. Bob's going to hook up with Sister Ignatia at St. Thomas Hospital. and she's going to sneak the first guy in through the back steps and put him in the flower room. We'd worn out our welcome at City Hospital. And can you imagine the first guy waking up in the flower room there coming out of a blackout? He probably thought he was at the funeral parlor instead of the hospital. And the interesting thing about Sister Ignatia is that she would work with the men, but she wouldn't work with the women. She thought we had a moral problem. And but what she would give those men is the Sacred Heart medallion. And I've seen many an old-timer shake and pull that out of his wallet and weep. And she would tell them, if you want to take a drink, bring this back to me. And I would, I think this one should play okay. This will be Sister Ignatia telling you about Ann Smith.
This group or any alcoholic should often say a prayer for Ann, because she was the backbone of this. In her calm, quiet way, she was really an angel. I would call her and say, "Oh, Ann, I'm so worried about this fellow." She knew most of them from either reputation or doctor telling about them. And she would get to the doctor if it was anything serious, but otherwise she'd say, "Now, don't worry about it." Because they're alibiologists, in other words. And I learned they were. They do anything to promote another drink or treatment of some kind.
Yeah, we've got some alibiologists, all right. Yep. Well, Sister Ignatia and Dr. Bob together, they worked with over 4,800 patients. Dr. Bob never charged a dime. And together, that's how many people went through. And in 1950, we're going to lose Dr. Bob. But there's a plaque there, still outside the chapel now, and you'll read about it in AA Comes of Age. Where we dedicated that to her. And when she left after Dr. Bob died, she'll go up to Cleveland, Charity Hospital in Cleveland, and they'll start a hospital up there, and they'll call it Rosary Hall Sanitarium, RHS. Those are Dr. Bob's initials, Robert Holbrook Smith, and she hid that in the name. But when she left, we loved her so much that in the early morning hours, we lined the bridge, and this is the bridge where they used to take the alcoholics. You can see St. Thomas Hospital up there to the left. It was early morning, and the cars lined the bridge, and they turned their headlights on, and they stood outside their cars to escort her on her way. I think that's kind of a touching story. We now have a chapel, if you come to Akron, that's dedicated to her. It's a beautiful chapel. She will take Bill through the Stations of the Cross. And right up where the ward was, there was a choir loft. And the guys from the ward would come into that choir loft. You couldn't see them up there. But that's where many an alcoholic learned to say their first prayers. And sometimes they'd say to her, "Sister, pray for me." And she'd tell them, "Well, go pray for yourself. God loves to hear from strangers." The mosaic up here is the mosaic of the Good Samaritan. So if you have a chance to visit, look at the beautiful stained glass windows about visiting the sick and visiting the people in jail and all the things that Alcoholics Anonymous does, as well as the Good Samaritan there in that mosaic. Also, you know, 1939 was a big year for us. One of the things that happens is the book is going to get published in April, and in May, Cleveland's going to break away, start a group. And by the end of the year, we are moving into Dr. Bob's house. We'll move. That's our flying blind period. You know, until we had the book, we were using Oxford Group. Now that we have the book, by November, December that year, we move into the Smith home. There's 74 of us. By January, we move into King School. And that later became known as King School Group. That was group number one, coming out of that alcoholic squad. And this had a lot to do with the women. The women are still considered part of AA, but they had special duties. And some of those was to wash dishes and make that coffee. And in the early days, women sat on one side of the room and the men sat on the other. Refreshments were Ann Smith's part of the meeting. And she went from table to table to introduce herself, and she never forgot anyone's name. Even the later years when she went blind, she would often speak to people and remember them and their families. And she would say, I want to welcome you and your lovely wife to Alcoholics Anonymous. We hope you will keep coming back. So now you know where we got that. It was the wives who sought help for their husbands. They helped with meetings. They opened their homes. They did the 12-step work at that time. They were considered part of AA. They called to get men to visit patients in the hospital. And they worked on the directories. They planned the picnics. They would do anything they could. This is depression times to get those men back to work. So they're always coming up with picnics and parties and lots of fellowship. You're looking at a picture of Ruth Hawk. Ruth Hawk was our first secretary. She was once Hank's secretary. She later came with us. She didn't really know what she was getting herself into, though. She didn't really see too many people when they started that honors dealers. You know, she thought she was going to be a secretary, but she didn't see many car products being sold. She either saw somebody passed out or down on their knees making surrenders. So here she is here, and then she would be paid with those worthless stock certificates. And little did she know that the book that she was typing would one day save her daughter's life. I am friends with Lori from Chicago, who has over 30 years of sobriety. So we never know, do we? I'm going to let her tell you a little bit about that.
As I said, I think I was a very good secretary, and I didn't like the various jobs I had at that time. And for one reason or another, I'd simply tell them I was quitting in 2 weeks and do so, and I was always able to get a job. Of course, it was depression times, and it didn't work for much. But I actually came to them through an agency. I had contacted an agency for a secretary, and that's what I thought I was doing at the time.
That's a riot. We have her to thank as a secretary. She was opening mail one day, and in an obit was a serenity prayer. And she liked it so well that she sent it out to us, and that's how it became part of our program. That goes back to Ruth. It was actually written by someone else, Reinhold Niebuhr, but she's the one that sent that out. And there's her typewriter. Now, we live in an age of word processing, but can you imagine Bill Payson behind you with a cigarette in his mouth trying to dictate some of those chapters and her pecking away at that thing and how difficult that manuscript must have been? Boy, I remember those days. We gave her the 5 millionth copy of the big book in Montreal. I don't know if any of you were there, but actually, according to her daughter, we forgot it, and they had to grab a book from somebody in the audience, but they later gave her the 5 millionth copy. That is funny. Lori loves to tell that story. Doesn't that alcoholic?
Yeah.
We're going to give you the 5 millionth copy, but we don't have one, so they scavenger through the audience. This is what says in Bill's first edition, first printing big book, the first one off the press. He dedicates it to Lois, one whose loving care and fortitude in our dark days together made these pages possible. So to her, this first book of the first edition is lovingly and thankfully given Bill in memory of the fifth Christmas, 12/25 of 39. Anybody know who that old boy is? That's Clarence Snyder. He came in February 11th of 1939, but it wasn't because he came in. It was because of his wife, Dorothy, who said, if you don't do something, I'm going to leave you if you don't see Dr. Bob. She even bought him the bus ticket. And there's Dorothy. She did a lot. I mean, there's a pamphlet. She had a reverend talk about him, which later became a pamphlet. She was like a switchboard operator in 1939. Picture this. We've got about a dozen guys sober. The Cleveland Plain Dealer writes some articles about us, and 500 people come in. Yeah, think about that. There was a lot of sponsorship going on in Cleveland. In fact, about 80% of our membership was coming from Cleveland in the 40s by that time. And it was Dorothy who made all those calls and helped do some of the organizing of that sponsorship. She was also, coincidentally enough, her sister is married to Hank Parkhurst. Small world, huh? She is going to be with Ruth and Bill and Hank when they go up to Cornwall Press and they take that working copy of the big book up there. They all have to accompany it because it's so sloppy and messy that they have to help them typeset it. And she's with them. And I'm going to let Ruth tell you about what that was like. I think.
Yes, and some of you may know Clarence of Cleveland, who was a great, had so much to do with starting the Cleveland AA groups. His wife had a sister in Bronx, New York, and she had come to visit the sister and had met Bill. And she called Bill up and said she was in town and she'd like to see him. He said, "We're up at Cornwall, come on up," you know. And I must say, like most men of good taste, Bill liked pretty girls too. And Dorothy was a lovely, warm, just humor, full of laughter person, and he liked Dorothy very much. So there we were, the four of us, and I had never met Dorothy before, but we immediately developed a perfect rapport, as though we'd known each other all our lives. And after we had done the stint for the day, she and I shared a bedroom, and we were talking away, and this must have been 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning. There was a knock on the door, and it was Bill. And Bill couldn't sleep. Hank was sound asleep somewhere, but Bill couldn't sleep. And we had coffee sent up, Dorothy and I. So we were in a room with one big double bed, so Bill just got right in the middle, and there we were. And we talked the rest of the night, the three of us, in that position.
Imagine that. A little history you didn't know about, huh? I just threw this in for the fun of it. It's just hilarious, isn't it? There's Bill and two babes. I don't know who they are, but I just like that picture. Marie Bray was the wife of the first guy that they snuck into the flower room, and he was the backslider. And Bill, in the very first writing of the book, she wrote a chapter to the wives. Well, now it's time for a couple AA women to make the scene. The first one I want to talk about is Sylvia Kaye, and she came from Chicago. She came to Akron, but we were too nervous about women then, and Bob wouldn't work with women, so they sent her up to Cleveland, and Dorothy, who I just introduced, worked with her. And she was from Chicago. She was beautiful. She was divorced, and she was rich. So you can imagine that was going to rock the boat a little bit. She came with her non-alcoholic secretary, Grace Coltus. And Grace Coltus would go back to Chicago and start the first intergroup office in her apartment. I just visited the Chicago office, and I have a picture of Grace to show you. I don't even know if they knew who she was, but I got so excited. I said, "Don't you know who that is? That's the woman who started the first intergroup office." So you see, a lot of the story doesn't have to do with alcoholics. It has to do with Friends of Alcoholics Anonymous. So we're back at Clinton Street here, and the gal on the left is Marty Mann. And Marty Mann is going to be a patient of Dr. Tebow's. And we don't have the book yet. She's going to get a copy of the manuscript, and she's going to read it, and she's going to want to go find out what this is all about. So she goes by train to Clinton Street, and she's going to be the first woman to enter what they called the drunk squad. So let's listen to what she tells us, what that was like for her.
That was the greatest feeling I had. And yet, there wasn't a woman member there. I was it. Now, I'll grant you there are a lot of nice things about that.
You bet.
Particularly since a lot of the men didn't have wives. On the other hand, I really did feel that it would be very nice to talk to another woman alcoholic. I had met a couple in the sanitarium. In fact, I knew of one who was no longer there and who needed what we had, but she wasn't there at the moment and I didn't quite know how to get to her. But I asked immediately, I said, "Aren't there any women in this group?" There was a story in this manuscript about a woman, but I hadn't met her. And I found that she was living in Washington, her name was Florence, where she and a man named Fitz had gone to try and start a group. And I looked forward very eagerly to her return to New York or her visit to New York so I could meet and talk with her. She was a considerably older woman and she had a great many physical problems too. And unfortunately, I only saw her sober on a couple of occasions. And she died before I had anywhere near completed my first year. So that did not really answer my need. And as the months went on, I worked awfully hard to get some companions in there. I don't know how many women I tried to help, but I didn't.
That older woman was chasing younger men. That was her downfall. I have a picture of Bobby, and I haven't put it in yet, so you just have to imagine this is Bobby Berger.
And none of them made it, but she did. Her name was Bobby. And Bobby Berger later became the secretary of what is today GSO, where she worked for many years and where her name became known to AAs all over the world because she was the one who corresponded with them. And this was the gal I said couldn't make it.
If you get a chance to go down to your archives, there are quite a few letters to Arkansas from Bobby Berger. And Ruth, there are some from Ruth Hawk. And these letters that were coming out of the office, Bill's only in the office one day a week. You know, we've almost lost the art of letter writing through texting and emailing. But the beautiful letters, the 12-step work that the women were doing in our office is just beautiful writing. So Bill, when they started this club, they were going to call it 100 Men. Well, when Florence got sober just in the nick of time, she says, you can't call it 100 men. You got to call it 100 men and one woman. Of course, she didn't make it. So then, but she was AA's first woman, and her story is a feminine victory. She returned 1939 to drinking and died of an apparent suicide. Well, let's face it, there's a stigma. There was a double standard. I need hardly say how much we all know that the stigma around a woman alcoholic is much greater than around men. Our language says boys will be boys, but there's no such thing as women will be women. It's much harder for a woman to admit to alcoholism than it is for a man to admit to it. Therefore, the death rate from alcoholism percentage-wise in women who have alcoholism is higher than it is in men who have alcoholism. That comes from Bill White's book on alcoholism. Women alcoholics had to overcome a double standard that was even more rigid in the 1930s than it is today. The notion was that nice women don't drink to excess. Most women came in with the label nymphomaniac. Well, let me tell you about the nice Southern ladies. This comes from your archives. And there's a beautiful woman by the name of Faye W. from Little Rock who took a lot of time to put your history together, and some of the best history on women I've ever found. I just had a ball down there yesterday. All right, so nice Southern ladies, and this is in the book, nice Southern ladies, on the other hand, simply did not drink. Therefore, it was believed to be impossible for a Southern lady to become an alcoholic. This double standard manifested itself in the different ways men and women alcoholics were treated in the South prior to Alcoholics Anonymous. Men were more often than not placed in sanitariums and hospitals while women ended up on the streets or were incarcerated for the crime of drunkenness. That's sad. The first women in sobriety in AA in Arkansas were by necessity a hardy group. They had to subject themselves not only to the open shame of seeking help for their alcoholism, but to the lack of understanding of the men, remember the no woman rule, who greeted them and sometimes barred their way at the doors of AA meeting rooms in Arkansas at that time. Every woman member today owes a debt of gratitude to those women, but also to those brave men who bucked their society standards and prejudices to help them into recovery. Is there anyone here from Fort Smith? All right, I'm going to talk about your girls next. 1945, when they were on 6th Street, one of their first women showed up at more than one meeting, and they realized she might want to stay with the fellowship. One member of the group said, "We realize what you want. To have," but he said, "you can't have it." They literally dragged her out and told her not to come back. According to one old timer, they had a real hard time accepting women. Yeah, it's think of the theme of this conference today. And we've come a long way, haven't we? Thank God. Now, the first woman to stay sober, although Marty Mann's sobriety will break even in the 60s. She also relapsed within the first 18 months of AA. But she was quite a gal. She was smart, and she saw that there was this stigma, not just on women, but stigma on alcoholics. So she started the National Council on Alcoholism to educate the public on the disease of alcoholism. And she wanted to change it from a moral problem into a health problem. And here's a little movie.
Alcoholics Anonymous and other organizations combating alcoholism are gaining ground, bringing to the public a sense of the true nature of the problem through such spokesmen as the director of the National Committee for Education on Alcoholism, Mrs. Marty Mann.
Alcoholism has too long been a taboo subject, just as tuberculosis used to be 40 years ago. We're trying to teach people the truth, but alcoholism is a disease, and that because it is a disease, it should have no stigma attached to it. Alcoholics should be dealt with like other sick persons, in hospitals and clinics, not in jails. Alcoholism, America's fourth greatest public health problem, can be solved by community action. The National Committee stands ready to help your community plan such action.
Science has not yet fully explained the inner mechanisms of the problem drinker. But today it has been demonstrated through experience that the sympathy and understanding of one alcoholic can help reclaim another, and that in such brotherhood lies many an alcoholic's last, best hope.
You think you're sunk. You think you're through. Well, you're not. You may not be able to help yourself. There are plenty of us to help you, if you really want us to.
Time marches on.
Isn't that sweet? Well, you know, for a long time we thought this was the first lady, but she was the first lady with continuous sobriety because it did not, her link did not break at all. She never relapsed. Her story was from farm to city. I don't think it's any longer in the fourth edition. But she was the first woman to get sober in Akron. She weighed 300 pounds, so she wasn't much of a threat. Her husband was very thin, and they were like Mutt and Jeff. And I think she's going to tell you a little bit about what it was like for her to come into the first AA meeting.
And then we started at King School, which was the only group then, and we went there religiously for a year. We never missed a Wednesday night, and I just loved every bit of it. At first I thought that the wives would look down on me, and they didn't. I just can't ever fail to give the wives so much credit. They were such a help to me, and I thought that they probably they'd say, well, they say she's one of those things too. But the only thing that was said, and not in unkindness at all, they turned me over to Annabelle Gill, and she says, well, I understand you drink too. And I, instead of resenting it, I said, yes, that's what I'm here for. And we saw several different people that we knew.
When the early women came in Cleveland, the wives threw them out. In many areas of the country, the women had done so much to help Alcoholics Anonymous. When the early alcoholic women showed up, they were a threat. And it wasn't the men that they had trouble with, it was the wives. This is another picture of Ethel at a Founders Day. And here's the first sober woman west of the Mississippi, and her name is Sybil Doris Adams Stratton Hart Maxwell Willis C. Now, she had read The Liberty that had came out, and then some of you are familiar with the Saturday Evening Post. And she read it, and she called New York, and she wrote to Ruth Hawk, and Ruth Hawk sent her to her first meeting. And she went to that first meeting, but let me have her tell you what happened at that meeting.
Continued by saying, if there are any women here, they must go. And he meant me, I thought. Because I didn't see any other women there. I didn't see any other women there. It turned out there had been a couple, you know, sitting over kind of at the side, and they were non-alcoholic wives. It was simply that those good fellows there had had a closed meeting for a couple of years, and a couple of the wives, or three or four of the wives, came down. They just wandered outside and sat on the davenport and talked about their husbands, or knitted, or exchanged recipes or something, because there was no Al-Anon, no program for them. And I guess he spotted these two women over there and said, as is our custom, will the women please wait outside and come back in for refreshments? But it was just as good as throwing me out bodily when he said, the women go. That was me. That was all. I was so self-concerned, so I left.
And she drank that night. And they kept her husband, who was the non-alcoholic. But she did get back in touch with New York, and New York put her in touch with Mortimer Joseph, and I'm going to let her tell you what happened the second time she went to that meeting.
He got down to the last stack with a big rubber band around it, about 50, and he said, I've been saving these to the last because they're all from women. And we have a woman alcoholic now. Her name is Sybil. So come on up here, Sybil. I'm putting you in charge of all the women. And I thought, boy, I got promoted in a hurry. And now I'm in charge. So I tottered up there, and as I told you last night, I said, I can't, why can't you? I said, I'll be drunk next Friday. I always have been. It won't be any different unless...
Here, what had happened is the Saturday Evening Post, all the inquiries that came in from women, they didn't know how to answer them because they didn't have a woman sober. So how would you like to have on your first meeting somebody hand you a stack of 50 women who needed a 12-step call? She managed to stay sober. This is the flower of the South. This is Esther E., and she sobered up in Houston, and she moved to Dallas and had meetings in her home. But there's a little story here that goes with this as well. Some of you are familiar with the 24-hour book. But there was a book that preceded that called God Calling. That book, God Calling, remember I told you about the listeners from the Oxford Group? Well, there were two women listeners from the Oxford Group, and they wrote down their guidance like the Oxford Group folks did. And A.J. Russell came along, and he edited that book, and he called it God Calling. Richmond Walker would get sober in 1942, and he had that book, and he read it, and he took each page of that book, and he gave us a prayer and a meditation for alcoholics, and they called it the 24-hour book. So behind your 24-hour book are two women listeners. This is an early, I just threw that graphic in there, but use your imaginations. There was a rather large gal who sponsored early women in AA in Akron, and if they say, and from Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, if she sponsored you and you got drunk, she'd pick you up and slap you around. Then she'd tell you, if you didn't get sober, you were going to get some more. I don't know what happened to her sponsees. How many of you know about Irma Lavoni? Yeah, here's the Irma Lavoni letter. Dear Mrs. Lavoni, at a meeting of the Executive Committee of the Los Angeles Group of Alcoholics Anonymous held December 4th, 1941, it was decided that your attendance at group meetings was no longer desired until certain explanations and plans for the future were made to the satisfaction of this committee. This action has been taken for reasons which should be most apparent to yourself. It was decided that should you so desire, you may appear before members of this committee and state your attitude. This opportunity will be afforded you between now and December 15, 1941. You may communicate with us at the above address by that date. In case you do not wish to appear, we shall consider the matter closed and your membership is terminated. Alcoholics Anonymous, Los Angeles Group. How about Francis P.? Frances P. is the first gal sober in Arkansas. She wanted sobriety really bad. She said, I'll ride down Main Street with the G-string on a horse if you'll let me. Madeline talked last night about wanting it so much that she was going to get naked too. What is it about women when they want something really bad? We just take our clothes off. That's where the power is, right? All right, a great fine article comes out in 1944. I believe this was written by a woman. Ready? The percentage of the women who stay in AA is low. Many women form attachments too intense, bordering on the emotional. So many women want to run things. Did you notice there was a lot of male laughter on that? I didn't hear one woman laugh. Too many women don't like women. Now that time the women laughed. Women talk too much. Everybody laughs. Women are questionable help working with men and vice versa. The article goes on. Sooner or later, a woman on the make sallies into a group on the prowl for phone numbers and dates. No, sir. A lot of women are attention demanders. Few women can think in the abstract. Ooh. Women's feelings get hurt too often. Far too many women in AA cannot get along with the non-alcoholic wives of AA members. Do you believe that appeared in a grapevine? Well, here's another magazine. I don't know how many of you will remember Confidential Magazine. But they had an article in there that said, Alcoholics Anonymous, no booze, but plenty of babes. I want to talk to you just a little bit about a gal who was a great friend of Alcoholics Anonymous, and her name is Nell Wing. I met her at Founders Day while I was seating Lois, and she and I became very good friends. And while seating her at a banquet, I said, Nell, if there's ever anything I can do for you, just ask. And she said, yes, Gail, I'd like you to start an archives. So it was in 1983 that I said yes to Alcoholics Anonymous and began the work of keeping our history and our family album. She was a true friend of AA. She was a companion to Bill and Lois. She came into the office after Ruth and Bobby were gone. And she just was like around all the time. She really knew more about AA history because she was there to observe it with Bill at the office and then later with Lois. She started out as a receptionist.
Two groups of people that, three groups, young people, gay people, and women, who really had a hard time finding a home. Let's face it, AA in very early days was a gentleman's, almost, forgive me for saying this, but was almost a gentleman's club. Women had, we had experience very early on with women and guys and, you know, boy and girls and shenanigans. And that varied, especially in Akron. Dr. kind of a dim view of all this. And so women were, it was a little suspicious and whatnot. I think about the first women's group was about 43 or 42 in Ohio, Cleveland, somewhere is there. But they had a very hard time. I remember women coming, just like in those early days in the Washingtonians, the women's wives groups of Martha Washingtons.
Martha Washingtons.
took in and sheltered and helped alcoholic women that they had because some of the men wouldn't do it. And so there were a lot of categories that made the AA had to kind of open its doors in many, many different directions, and they did indeed start it. I can remember, of course, the way.
So you can see about the diversity from the early days. That's a picture I took of her at Stepping Stones because I went and I studied under Nell. At the time, we had just purchased Dr. Bob's house, and I was going to put the archives in there. She said, Gail, AA can't own property. If you want to be an AA archivist, you can't put it in the house. You could be a foundation archivist, but not an AA archivist. I spent 3 days trying to talk her out of our traditions, and that's how I eventually left and ended up at our office. Nell was like a Wilson. If you visit Stepping Stones, there was a bedroom. That is her bedroom. And here's just a darling picture of her always traveling with Lois in the later years. Here's a picture that was taken when I was in Little Rock. And we were there for a convention there. And it was a wonderful time. And here's something to tell you a little bit about the New York women.
One of the most dramatic jobs in combating alcoholism is being done by the voluntary organization called Alcoholics Anonymous. AA offers help freely to any alcoholic anywhere who is willing to admit his own inability to help himself. And though not a religious organization, its 12-step program calls for belief in some power outside the individual. Direct contact with those for whom help is asked is made only by AA members who themselves have gone the long road from alcoholism to sobriety.
We lost Nell February 14th of 2007. That was a great loss to us. Ann Smith, 1949, a year before we lose Dr. Bob. Just simple graves. Lois Wilson, 1988. Ethel Macy. And Henrietta Seiberling. The interesting thing her son pointed out to us when we found out where she was buried, she died in 1979, and he says, do you know what's printed on that simple tombstone? And of course, at that time, we didn't. He said, let go and let God. And I'd like to close with a quote from Maya Angelou. You know, I don't know how many old-time women are in this room or how many you know, but I certainly hope after you hear the story, it's the tough broads that made it. We'll never know how many women died because the hand of AA wasn't there. And I think it helps us appreciate those who have gone before us. So I'd like to close with this quote. When we cast our bread upon waters, we can presume that someone downstream, whose face we may never see, will benefit from our action, even as we enjoy the gifts sent to us from a donor upstream. Thank you so much.